relax. Among friends, speak now for whoever will be pleased.
I would like to suggest that Brian Brundine, the youngest member of the board, say something.
Hey, 93 years old and walked the trail from Dawson. All I can think of there is I think every day what we do here at this university is just as much a pioneering effort. We'll look back and think how wonderful it was, and I think now how wonderful it is to be just a part of it, because it's where things are happening, and it's with the most wonderful people that I know that make them happen. I think I speak for all Regents that it is a wonderful pleasure to be associated with the university.
More appointments.
The Great Hall has seen a lot of good use this past year by many campus organizations, and we've asked John Gruen to speak in behalf of the Associated Students. John.
Thank you, Marshall Wood, Marshall Cashin, Lieutenant Governor Boucher, past and present members of the Board of Regents, President O'Neill, Patty, Dr. Patty, students, friends, and guests. This dedication of Regent's Great Hall would be better to be called a rededication to service. For in the past year and a half, we have noticed many activities in this building, such activities as music, Choir of the North, as was demonstrated. University chorus, university band, and orchestra have performed and held rehearsals in this building. Student recitals, faculty recitals as well, have been held. Other activities have been of an academic nature. Conferences and seminars, hearings have been held. One such conference was the Conference of the Bering Sea, which attracted scientists not only from the university in the state of Alaska, but the United States, Canada, Scandinavia, and Russia. Activities also include a drug seminar, birth control seminar, and also a hearing which has had statewide significance and also community significance was the Senate subcommittee hearings held just recently. The subcommittee was chaired by Senator Montoya of New Mexico, and also on that committee were Senators Mike Gravel and Ted Stevens. Such witnesses before the committee were our Governor Bill Egan. But the most influential of activities have been the student activities. Three of which come to mind are student registration, in which students come, wait in line to pay their fees. They wait and wait. Another is multimedia blowout. Just recently, as you would enter this building, there was an array of projectors, sounds, food, odors, anything that you could think of, which, in a sense, blew out all five of your senses. One other that comes to mind was a talk given by Dave Brower, who is president of the Friends of the Earth, an environment organization on a worldwide basis. ASUA invited him up last semester, and his talk was on the preservation of energy, the need of conservation, and the general importance of energy. And it was during this discussion that the lights went out. So looking at these varied activities, we find that this hall has served in a unique manner, but in a manner that students will remember and appreciate. It has served better than people could have contemplated. We can say this also about the Board of Regents, after whom this hall is named, for they too have given unselfish service to this university. at least 2 months of each year are given in university matters. We, as students, in accepting this hall, should feel grateful for the service that the Board of Regents have given us, and we as students should be given such service and should give such service. One goal in which we might dedicate ourselves from going this building is to consider membership of 2 students on the Board of Regents. This is not the idea of power to the people. It's the idea of unselfish giving, giving not only to our fellow students, but to the university, the community, and to the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, in closing, few reminders. There's an informal reception at the close of the program, and I think there are some refreshments, and of course you're all invited to remain. And you're welcome, of course, to come up and examine the plants at close range. And we have some interesting displays in the back showcases on the opposite wall. We thank you all for coming, and the program goes with the singing of Alaska's flag by the choir of the moon.
Stars of gold on a field of blood. Alaska's flag made it mean to you the blue of the sea, the evening sky, the mountain lakes and the flowers nearby.
Marshal of the University, it's my pleasure to welcome you to this dedication of the Harriet and Luther Hess Dining Commons. I think the pioneers of Alaska and the alumni of the earlier years are especially happy that the Board of Regents have named this new facility in honor of these 2 Alaska pioneers who played such a prominent roles in the establishing and nurturing of this institution in its early years. I'm pleased to introduce Mr. William A. O'Neill, pioneer and an alumnus, and who is incidentally president of the Board of Regents, Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Bill. I've been trying for quite a long time to catch you to make a mistake. I think I finally got you where I want you. You should have known better than to put Patty and myself on the same program and both of us going to speak. I don't know whether to start telling stories, because if I did, I know he'd come back with some worse ones on me. But when you talk about the man who's going to make the dedicatory address today, you're practically talking about the University of Alaska. He was one of the first professors of this institution. He was the first dean of the School of Mines, first dean of the university, or the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines. And he was quite instrumental in seeing to it that I received a diploma from that institution. I was always grateful to him for that. There were times when he thought he should give up, but nevertheless, he did persevere. He made another mistake in having me join his organization in Canada for many years. And then after that, I thought it was time for me to get even with him, so I was instrumental in assisting in making him the third president of the University of Alaska, where I could have him under my thumb for a while. Dean Patty is much a history of the university, and we always refer to him as Dean because that's what his title was when all of us older fellows were going to university. So Dean Patty is as much the history of the university as anything I know of. He knows as much about the history of the university, except perhaps Cashin, but Cashin's got a little bit of a reach on him because Cashin's been studying the university for the last year. You know that, don't you? You know, he's been trying to write a book. So, without getting into any stories, why I want to present to you Dr. Ernest M. Patty, third president of the University of Alaska and a friend to all the people of Alaska.
You know, Bill was very careful not to tell any stories on me, but I hope the students won't listen to what I'm going to say now because he's president of the Board of Regents. In the old days, we had an old wooden dormitory here, and in the wintertime, we had an austerity program because of heat, and Dr. Bunnell would nail all the storm windows shut. And if you wanted any air, the only thing was you could put a little thing like that, and then sometimes they'd turn the heat on, and it got like a furnace in there. And so they had a freshman, they were the minor for training this freshman, and he called the freshman down and he said, get these windows open, I want some air in here. The freshman over tried to get the window open, couldn't get the window open, and Bill says, you know what to do, don't you? He says, yes, sir. He picked up a prospect, he picked, threw it through the window. Bill said, I couldn't get over to the printer's office fast enough to pay for that window. And he said, I said to this freshman, that's the way we do things around here. Well, this is rather a strange audience to talk to because we have, I see in the back, some of the freshmen and some of the students. Some of them, I don't suppose, have actually seen the ice go out yet. They are back there where they can get out if I get too dull for them. And some of the rest of you are here. I see people here who were here before we came and who are good friends of Harriet and Luther Hess, who we're going to honor today. I hope those who are later arrivals in Alaska will pardon me for just a minute or two while I reminisce. And I'm going to start out at the railroad depot in Fairbanks. It isn't the railroad depot that you see there now. It's a little small depot. And there was a narrow-gauge train standing at the depot. It consists of a little small engine, three freight cars, a baggage car, and a coach in the back, which were the stove in one end, and some brass lamps which hung over and bounced around as you went around the curve. And we started out, came out to College Station. That was the first stop. I think that's where I got on. And then we went on out. The rails led us out to Goldstream, then up Goldstream to Fox. Now, some of you, these are strange names, but they were very real to us in those days. And some of the other people here today would be very real to them. And then from just beyond Fox a little ways, the train started switchbacking up this way to get up on the summit. And as I said, it's a little later than it could, because it huffed and puffed and finally got us up to a place called Ridgetop, which is up on the summit. Then we coasted down on the other side to Olus, which is at the mouth of Dome Creek. And that particular day, Luther Hess, Cal Franklin, Judd McClellan, and I got off the train. This was 1923. My guys, that was almost 50 years ago. And we got off the train there and got our pack sacks on and started over the trail to walk to Livengood, a distance of about 50 or 60 miles, as I remember. Just nothing but a trail now. There's a road over there. And it meant crossing over summits, one thing or another. And I wondered just what sort of fellow Luther Hess was. I knew that he'd come to Alaska and come to Klondike in the days of the gold rush. I knew at one time he'd been president of the territorial senate. I knew that he was a successful banker. I knew he'd had very wide mining interests. And I knew in his earlier years he'd been an attorney and he'd been a teacher. And I knew all those things in a general way, but it takes a few days on the trail with a man to really find out just who he is and what he is. And this worked out very well with Luther, because he carried his own pack, carried just as much as any of the rest of us. And he never complained. Sometimes we'd get over to some of these summits, were pretty tough going with a pack on your back. And then we'd get down the swamps and we'd be battered by the mosquitoes. And he never complained. Then we got into the first night. I got into one of the old abandoned roadhouses where we were going to stay, and I went down. We started to cook some supper, and I went down with a pail to get some water. And here was Luther, sitting there by the creek with sand scouring the old rusty plates and the old rusty cups, and I won't call them silverware, just old knives and forks and spoons. And that was his only gesture to a little bit of nicer living. And I didn't, little did I realize that as I sat and looked, this fellow sort of laughed at him. I thought, my gosh, he's kind of a particular guy, isn't he? But it never dawned on me as I sat and looked at him sitting there, that this man was going someday to will a considerable portion of his fortune to the university. And that fortune, those several hundred thousand dollars had been invested by the university. And they draw several thousand dollars a year interest, which is used for scholarships here. There are many students on this campus who've been, needy students, who've been put through school due to the generosity of Luther Hess. So I think we should acknowledge that. Some of you, of course, knew Harriet Hess. Some of the rest of you have seen pictures of her. She looked a little austere in her pictures, and she really was a handsome woman, a very reserved sort of a person. And I don't think at any time I ever spoke of her as Harriet. I always spoke of her as Mrs. Hess. And I think those of you know her or remember that you probably felt the same way. And I never called her anything except Mrs. Hess. I've often wondered if I had just said, "Good morning, Harriet," whether she might have liked it. But I never had a chance to. She came to Alaska, I think, in 1902, if I quote remember correctly, and was superintendent of the first full four-year high school at Juneau. Then she came on to Fairbanks and was principal of the high school here in Fairbanks. And then in 1972, she was made a member of the first board of trustees, as they called them then, of the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines. She was continuously, when it became in 1935 the University of Alaska, she continued on, she was reappointed as Board of Regents of the University and continued until the time of her death, which I believe was in 1951. The period of about 34 years that her whole life was entwined with the university. When she first saw this campus, of course, it wasn't very much, when I first saw it, there wasn't very much on it, but when she first saw it, there were nothing but a few rows of birch trees and clumps of brush. Not a building on the campus when she first saw it. Some of the most vital years of the university were accomplished during her period on the board. In those days, one thing stands out in my memory, the president at that time was appointed by the Board of Trustees on a year-to-year basis. And there was a political faction that felt the last man to be president of the university was Dr. Bunnell because he was a Democrat. So it was seldom a board meeting went by where there wasn't complaints and somebody wanted him discharged. And two or three, one, I remember one very dangerous session they were having, and it looked like the opposition might win out. And we were all very anxious. I saw Mrs. Hess in the hall about 5 minutes after this crucial board meeting, and she looked at me and she said, have you learned who's going to be the new president of the university next year? And I guess she saw the dismay in my face because she quickly, she said, a man by the name of Charles E. Bunnell. And I could see the devilment in her eyes, so she was quite a human person. Neither Luther or Harriet Hess lived to see the university fully come into its own. Can you imagine their reaction if they could come on this campus today? It's the winning of an impossible dream. They would be absolutely lost. There's nothing here that they. I imagine Scarlett's cabin up here on the hill was not here. It might have been kind of Mrs. Hess to death. It might have been there. There were some things, though, that's happening today that would have troubled them no end. They'd have been bewildered and troubled by the unrest that we see on some campuses, an unrest which have seriously damaged some of the most prestigious universities. I strictly see Dr. Odegaard at the University of Washington, from the University of Washington, and the tremendous strain that man is living under, and the bombing of buildings on campus. Fortunately, we don't have those problems here, but the University of California has gone through an absolute terrible period. They wouldn't have understood that, or they wouldn't have been able to comprehend it. They lived in an age that believed in the teaching of a sense of discipline in the home and in the school. They believed that there should be respect for law and order and the rights of others, and that no nation could long survive without that. They believed that the American flag and meditation should be in every schoolroom. They would be totally unable to comprehend the submissive attitude that prevails in our schools, our society, and even into our courts. A belligerent student might say to them, it's my own right to do my own thing, to do as I please. I can imagine him saying such a thing to Harriet, not to say Harriet, or Luther Hess. They would look him straight in the eye, and they'd say, young man or young woman, forever right, there is a corresponding obligation. And that's the way they would talk. They didn't budge around, they didn't move around the corner to try to rationalize too much. They just came right out with it. They didn't live in this great area of the goofball, where some workers strike for more wages and less work, and where some students look for SNAP courses. I don't think many of the students on this campus are looking for SNAP courses. As I watched them the other day, when they were at the station there yesterday in the food service building, I can realize that most of them weren't looking for SNAP courses, and I'm very proud of them. And where in this new fall, where some faculty are more concerned with extraneous things than they are with actual teaching of the young people. This is an era where it seems as though there is a flight away from responsibility. Luther and Hess, I've often thought that Luther and Harriet Hess were squares in present-day terminology. That's what average person, and I guess you've also guessed that I also am a square. Well, a square is not necessarily, I think it's a compliment. When you say, nice thing you can say about a man, he's a square shooter. Or you can say, I'll go to that store because I always get a square deal. Now, just what is a square? Well, each of you will probably have your own definition. I'll tell you one man's ideas of a square. You may not agree with all of it, but just think some of it will hit all right. A square is a guy who doesn't want to stop at the bar on the way home and get all juiced up because he wants to be home with his wife and his family. He is a guy who volunteers, but he doesn't have to. He is a guy who gets his kicks out of trying to do a little better job than the other person. He is a boob who gets so lost in his work, somebody has to tell him it's time to go home. This nut we call a square gets all choked up when he hears children singing the Star Spangled Banner or My Country 'Tis of Thee. He even believes in God, and he says so publicly. He's proud that he belonged to the Boy Scouts. How square can you get? Astronauts like Glenn, Shepard, Cooper, I guess practically all of them, would classify on that basis as squares. A square is likely to save some money for a rainy day rather than use yours. He gets his books from the library rather than from some book under the counter at a drugstore or a tavern. He is proud of his country, believes in honoring father and mother, and all that old stuff. That's a square. I hope I will not offend the faculty that have been a few of them here today when I say that I firmly believe that most of them are squares. I know from working with many of you that they are sincere men and women, interested in their students, and quietly each day doing a fine job. They don't get the headlines like some of the more radical people who have nursed too long at the academic town. But they just believe in doing a good square job, what they're paid for. Well, the students who are here today, please stand still when I say that the majority of them are going to be squares. Because life, the experiences of life, are going to metamorphose them into full-blown squares. I'm an optimist. The students that I knew on the campus here 10 years ago were as fine and dependable young men and women I've ever known. You could always count on them when the chips were down. And I don't believe the students today on this campus have changed very much over the past 10 years. I think fundamentally they're the same fine people. I'm glad, though, they're doing one thing that the students didn't do so much my day. I'm glad that they're becoming interested in politics, in ecology, and a war. They're more getting more concerned about these things, and they're thinking more seriously, I think. I know them, I did when I was a student. My only problem was to get through school. But I think I'm glad to see the students taking this active part in these things, and we certainly shouldn't discourage them. Most of the students don't want to goof off. They are in college at a severe financial sacrifice for themselves, to themselves and their parents. They treasure their years on campus, whether they have goals in science, engineering, medicine, law, or in the arts. I think the most interesting thing that I've seen in the last 2 days I've been on this campus happened yesterday noon in the Commons, when they were giving the student awards. That was, to me, was an absolute inspiration. And as long as we have young people, the caliber of those people who came up to receive their award yesterday, we haven't need to have no worry about the future of our country. After we got home back to the hotel last night, Virginia said, she said, did you notice that the students who were awarded were not necessary. He said, of course, there were grades for all 3 and 3.7 and 4, but that wasn't the only thing that won them the award. They had a diversity of interest. They were interested in this, interested in that, interested in the other thing. It was the most stimulating experience that I've had since I've been back on this campus. Now, of course, we do have the goof-offs. You have some on this campus. We have plenty of them at the university. And at first, I think most of us who are squares and most of us who believe in action guide to get things done and get in to do things have very little patience with these people. And I've stood on the curb as they march by and I've said what 100 other men say. They go by with a sign on their shoulder saying, make love, not war. And you look at them and this isn't original to me. You look at them and say, I don't believe they're capable of doing either one. But there is something behind all this. And I wish I could give you the answer. I wish the psychologists would work this out. Why do these people disengage themselves from the mainstream of life? There's some reason for it. I'm going to give you a layman's idea about it. I don't know whether it's any good or not. I learned one thing before I came back to this university as president, and that is the problem of children from a broken home. Not that all children who come from a broken home are in difficulties, but I remember the first time I found, when I got here, which I didn't like, was that the only person who could dismiss a student for cause other than grades was the president. It had to come under his signature. And I had been here 2 or 3 months, and Dean Halsey came in with a form, and he says, please sign here. And I said, what am I signing? And he said, we're having to dismiss a certain boy. I said, what's wrong? And he told me the thing. I said, well, no, that isn't too bad. I might have been caught in some of the things I did when I was in school. I might have been dismissed. And I said, I looked at the thing, I could see this boy was putting himself out to get attention. And I said, is this fellow a product of a broken home? And he said, I don't know, why do you ask? And I said, go back and find out. I said, I'll bet you he is. He came back, he went to the registrar's office and got his boy's record, he came back. He said, yes, he is. How did you know? I said, don't ever bring me in another thing to sign like this until you check on that, have a note on it, whether it is or not, and let me see the file. Because I felt like a judge sentencing somebody, and you don't do that too quickly. Some of these boys and some of the girls are just striving to get attention. I think that probably one of the most greatest motive forces in the world today is love. And I think some of these students, whether they came from broken homes or whether they came from unbroken homes, didn't get the love and attention that they wanted. And I think they're striving for it today. You know, one place I got that idea, I frequently, when I'm in the university district in Seattle, I walk out down University Way, and I see these people walking along, the girls with jeans on, sometimes their hair is nicely combed, sometimes it isn't. They don't wear any makeup, and the boys, they're certainly not very old. They're not going any place the way they're dressed. And you wonder, why do they do this? You see them walk along holding hands. And I stood on the corner and I watched these young people. I said, what are they thinking? What's causing all this? Then I noticed that quite a few of them, this gave me a clue. Quite a few of them have dogs. Now, a dog is one animal that if you give him attention, affection, he'd give it back to you. And I began to wonder if it really is, behind it all is a lack of love and a lack of attention. And I'll leave that to the psychologist to work out, but it's something that I think we shouldn't be too quick to condemn these young people. We've had some on this. This thing has always interested me. I stood over here by the new library building, the Fine Arts building, and I watched a boy and a girl come by, and they were both dead. The girl had on jeans, the boy had on jeans, he had an undershirt on, kind of a woolen undershirt on, and she had some sort of shoes on, but he had this sort of sandals. They were walking along, holding hands, and kind of smiling at each other. They apparently had found somebody who was interested in them. And I looked into their faces, and I watched two or three others around there, and I didn't see any viciousness in any of those faces. You take a look. I didn't see any. I wouldn't be afraid to meet them in a dark street. Probably they were people who weren't tough enough to stand the life that we lived, the circumstances that they lived. And sometimes I've heard some of my friends say, yes, they go into these rap sessions. And they sit around and tell you everything that's wrong with the world, everything is wrong with the nation. Then they take their food stamps and get out to the grocery store. Well, there's more to it than that. I think of anything I've been inclined, I've said a lot of these things myself, and I think of anything I've been inclined to be a little too rough on them. This isn't in the script, I just got, you'll have to pardon me, I just got started, couldn't stop. And what I really said in the script is this. It is difficult for me to comprehend how young people with good minds, intelligent but not wise, will disengage from the mainstream of life. How different from the great art critic, Renison, who on his 90th birthday said, there are so many interesting things yet in life that I want to do. There's so little time left to savor them. Now, this man talking who's 90 years old, if it would do any good, I'd be willing to stand on the street corner with my hat in my hand and beg the passersby for their unused hours. Which I thought was an unusual expression. Learning, whether it be in college or whether in life, is a serious and sometimes painful business. But that is where you find the genuine excitement of living. Luther Hess and Harriet Hess would have understood that. I think they would have understood and said almost amen to many of the things that I've tried to say to you today. They were very stalwart people. The people who are here who know them will back me up on that. They demonstrated by their lives that they believed in education, that they believed in young people, that they believed in the University of Alaska. I'm deeply moved today to have the opportunity of dedicating this beautiful new building to their honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Patty. And may I say that it seems like old times to have you back on campus. If my historical notes are correct, and I made a few, you delivered the principal address at the Bunnell Building dedication on May 22, 1960. You dedicated the Memorial Plaza on September 13, 1962. And, of course, you gave the response at the dedication of the Ernest N. Patty Building, October 18, 1963. And even further back, you gave the dedicatory address at the Brooks Memorial Mines Building in 1952. So I think you've established some kind of record, and thank you again. Now, we have a bronze plaque cast in the memory of Harriet and Luther Hess, and this will be placed at the main entrance to the dining room tomorrow. But today it's on this easel, and we've asked two of our women students, Leslie McClintock of Anchorage, who is Miss University of Alaska, and Miss Jody Jackson of Newport, Oregon, representing the Associated Students, to unveil the plaque at this time. The inscription reads, Harriet and Luther Hess Dining Commons, dedicated to the memory of Harriet Hess, Secretary of the Board of Trustees, 1917-1935, and Board of Regents, 1935-1951, and her husband, Luther Hess, pioneer attorney and legislator, in recognition of the leading roles they played in the founding and early development of the University of Alaska. This new dining facility will be used by the students residing in these three residence halls, Moore Hall, Bartlett Hall, and Scarland Hall. And speaking in behalf of the ASUA is Mr. Frank Henry, Chairman of the Food Advisory Committee and Assistant Resident Advisor of Moore Hall. Mr. Henry.
Thank you, Dr. Gashin. Good afternoon. Today marks a special day, and let us not lose the feeling of unity we have. We have joined together to honor two Alaskan pioneers who came to Alaska looking for new horizons in education. Here at the University of Alaska, we have lost touch with this goal. Excellence in education is needed, for unfortunately, there is a fractionalization of the campus. There is no balance between faculty and students, and student and faculty and administration. They are all separate entities occasionally passing in the night. If we are to name the structure in honor of Harriet and Luther Hess, then let us also embody the spirit with which the Hesses viewed the university and Alaska. As Harriet and Luther Hess lived, our campus should live, joined in mutual pursuits. It would be apropos to design a totalistic feeling on our campus. Education, as we know, is more than just a classroom and four sterile walls. It is the environment, the total environment, which we grow in, socially, academically, and spiritually. We, as students who live on this campus, because of the weather and winter conditions, spend 18 hours within these lifeless voids. We need spirit to join them together. Each structure that the Harriet and Luther Hess dining complex joins is also named after a prominent Alaskan. Wouldn't it be wonderful to embody their spirit in our structures? The Commons, being a place of joining for all students who will be Alaskans and future citizens of the world, is an interesting and wonderful place. We come each day joining, bringing new ideas, new feelings, new things we've been taught in the classrooms. This is spirit. Hopefully we can embody the whole campus with spirit. The soil beneath us is all we have to join our structures together. Even the buildings, which we are very thankful for, are not a total picture. Let us change these architects of disunity and find men whose creational vision and spirit can bring a totalistic picture to our campus. It is an honor for our structure here to be named after Harriet and Luther Hess, who are two distinguished citizens of the world, for we are part of an interesting and exciting state, and our campus does not reflect this feeling. Our campus should not be a stillborn child, but one which is dynamic, interesting, imaginative. Unfortunately, this is occurring all over the country, where the campuses are being fractionalized. There's no creativity. If we can find a spirit which is reflected by Luther and Harriet Hess and their dedication to the University of Alaska, then we can bring in an ensemble of feelings and emotions which will be an asset to our country and is an asset of our country. Thank you.
And we've asked Dr. William R. Wood, president of the university, to make the closing remarks. Dr. Wood.
That's a hard act to follow. Not only Dr. Patty, but to hear Frank speak. And he puzzles me a very great deal, and I hope, Frank, to have some conversation with you, see if I can grasp what it is that you are attempting to tell us. For I thought that common purpose which bound all of us together on this and on every campus in the country is learning. Trying to understand what the stored wisdom of the ages has assembled for us, and to analyze it, to interpret it, to take from it, and to attempt to apply it to conditions which we find in the world of which we are a part today. I still think that's the purpose of a university. Today, as in the earlier days for University of Alaska, when the Hesses were prominent here. And I think that what Dr. Patti had to say has great relevance and pertinence for us. Namely, that we do involve ourselves in attempting to understand, attempting to learn, and in a loyalty to the institution which provides that opportunity at very great expense to a great many people. And I should like very much, Frank, to have you come and talk with me and also to others on the campus here as to just what it is that you see in your dream that you seem to give us some at least edge of the vision. What you see in your dream would make the difference. You speak of spirit. And I too have felt at times the absence of this when occasions were set up and nobody showed. Even though in the planning there was active participation by students and faculty and people from the community, and nobody showed up for the occasion after it had been so carefully planned. And I thought, well, my, this is an absence of spirit. This is an absence of loyalty. What is it that people are loyal to? And again, I come back and wonder if there isn't something very special in what Dr. Patti had to say here in this respect, that we seem to have lost loyalty to anything except what it is that can interest us at the moment. And I keep wondering, too, if perhaps the multitude of voices that assail us today through the communications media might not be a might not have a disjointing effect upon each and every one of us. We so hear so many voices, many of them strident, and too many of them dissident, that I think we are left confused, that we lack something to hold on to in which we can genuinely believe. And I submit to you that it has been my experience that that comes from inside of the individual and is not something that is established outside of that individual. And he has to give something of himself, something deep from within himself, if he's going to be loyal to anything at all other than what at the moment seems to attract him, seems to interest him. He throws it away in a day or two. But at that moment, that's everything. And I say that's not enough for life. We've created here a very wonderful set of opportunities to learn. And surely in the idea of learning, we can develop a spirit and a loyalty the type that you're talking about. Now, I didn't intend to say anything of this sort, but the topic is brought up, and I think it needs to be discussed. And I agree with Dr. Patti that we have on our hands a generation of alienated people. And they didn't alienate themselves from the social and economic order in which they find themselves. And they keep telling me, even at my own table, that they didn't ask to be born into this sort of a milieu. But we do have this, the alienated and the disaffected. And they do blame everybody else for the situation. But I think also that they have within them the awareness, they have within them the capability, the capacity to do something positive and constructive about it. And certainly they have the freedom that no generation in the history of the world has ever had to speak their piece and to do their thing, to establish their loyalties, and to inflame the spirit. But it's not going to happen if they ask for somebody else to do it for them. It's got to come from inside them. And it has to be for a purpose greater than that of what the individual simply desires for himself. Our independence and freedom for the individual is a great thing. It is a keystone of our democracy. It is the central issue for free men everywhere. But at the point at which that independence for the individual interferes with the good of the group of which he's a member, then it must be kept in balance. Then the group must establish those controls which sees that the rights of the individual do not interfere with the greater rights of the greater group. I had the great privilege and pleasure of meeting Luther Hess. I was a senior, Frank, in the little college in Illinois from which Luther Hess had graduated. I don't know really, but I think some 35 years before. I graduated in that year, in 1927. That was the year that Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic. And Luther Hess came back to his home state of Illinois, where he was born there in the very heart of the prairie. And he attended the commencement exercises. In fact, I think they gave him some sort of an honorary degree on that occasion, although it may have been on a former one. And he met with the old literary society. In those days, we didn't have fraternities. We had literary societies where we met weekly, and we got off of our chests all of the things that were bothering us in debates, in declamations.